Welcome back to the Clean Sailors Podcast. Let's talk about sea, marine, sailing, and keeping it clean. I'm your host, Holly, founder of Clean Sailors, and a sailor myself with a passion for the health of our mighty oceans. Through conversations with experts, innovators, and activists, all working towards improving the health of our seas, we're showcasing the people and projects changing the way things are done. End-of-life boats. With an estimated 30,000 tons of composite waste from old boats being discarded in European landfills annually, we know this continues to be an issue or an opportunity. I'm joined by Jerome Watts, former champion sailor and now composite revolutionist, on the environmental impact of composite materials and how, through his company, Exo Technologies, he's looking at the state-of-art solutions to address the problem. Jerome, thanks so much for joining me.
And thank you, Holly, for contacting me.
Firstly, let's talk about your life as a champion sailor. Why sailing and where did that start for you?
My sailing actually started when I was really young. My grandparents lived on a lake near Gouda, where the cheese is from. Like, you always call it Gouda, but it's Gouda. And there's 11 lakes around. And I always saw this boat sailing when I was at my grandparents', always with binoculars, like, wow, this is what I want to do. Just got it. Just something, you know, as a little boy, just want to do it. So I started actually very early with sailing and been on dinghies mainly at that time, and start to grow slowly to keelboats, still racing actually. So it's been dominating my entire life, sailing. That's what it is. Yeah, you grow with teams, you go at a certain point, you are jumping at an event. You know, you're always standing on the quay, just like, if you need crew, I'm there. You know, just 12, 13-year-old boy jumping up and down. And there's always somebody who needs a crew because somebody's not available. So you just jump in and do all the jobs you can do.
Very opportunistic. I like that. And what are some of the coolest boats that you've sailed on? What have you seen?
That's a good question. In 2004, I did a race from Cape Town to Rio de Janeiro, which I never did. I never did transatlantics. I did a lot of offshore. And I was in Cape Town in 2003. Saw the start. And together with a couple of friends, we said, next edition, we're going to do this. This is such a cool thing to do. 4,000 nautical miles. What an adventure this will be. So we started to campaign this whole thing, this idea. And we got a boat for free from a company who was building racing yachts and said, can you win? I said, sure, we can win. Absolutely, Holly, absolutely no idea. So, okay, we know that we can get to the other side. That's not a problem. But, you know, we had a couple of teams. You know, one of a friend was many times a world champion on the laser, did three wet bread around the world. So not stupid people, but everything works when you're a team. And as well, the most weird kind of all walks of life. But what we did is we combined that all campaign, the money to could go. We had a yacht, we had everything sorted. We started to do fundraising and we donated all that money to the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. So 100% of the money, because we thought, you know, we are here like a couple of Europeans in South Africa where kids can't go to school. There's still a lot of problems and you sail to the other side of the world for a hobby on a very expensive yacht. It doesn't feel really right. So that's what we did. We won the race, more luck than wisdom, to be fair, honest. But okay, we won. It took us 20 days. And when we were in Rio, people asked me, do you want to do it again? Yeah, absolutely, but not 20 days because, well, 20 days is a long time. As you know, 20 days on a boat is pretty boring. Ocean racing is not always, you see all these heroic movies from the Volvo Ocean Race or now the Ocean Race or Imoca. They always, you know, the cameras goes on when it's really blowing. But in general, 70% is Club Med conditions, you know, but it's fast, but it can be faster. So when I came back to Rio, from Rio, I gave up my corporate job, started my own company, put all the money I've saved into development of a new yacht and want to beat the record, which I did. I wanted to make the boat really big. You know, I want to make 50 feet racing yacht. And I did it all with a very well-known naval architect with all my ideas. But then you see the quotes on material costing and you see the quote on design and things. So every week it became a meter shorter, this boat. So at the end, it was 37 feet with a tiller. And people in the newspaper in Cape Town, they were writing, there's a little dinghy participating in the race. I thought it was like a laser dinghy, a small little thing. But it was exceptionally fast. And from the start, we just... poof, we were first over the line at the start. And from that moment, no, we didn't see anyone anymore. We nailed the record in 16 days from Cape Town to Rio. And that's a record which still stands today. It was 2006. So no boat under 40 feet ever has beaten that record. So that's the coolest boat I've ever sailed on.
Not least because it was yours too, right?
There's an emotional twist in it. There's cooler boats I've been sailing on. You know, I've sailed on a Volvo VO70. When it comes to a boat, you constantly say, you have an idea in your head, you start to create it, you start to develop it, you start to build it, you start to make this whole thing start to go to a dream you want to do. and you nail it, that's the coolest boat I've ever done, I think. Yeah. It's still going. It's still in Antigua right now.
She does. In fact, I believe I saw her when I was there. It's incredible, Joe. And also, not least because, let's just go back to the first time you did the Cape to Rio. And being from South Africa myself, I appreciate a couple of things that you were talking about, and not least how important that race is, particularly because as Europeans, we're very used to going from, you know, the north of the Atlantic and using the winds that way. And obviously it's inverted somewhat when you're doing the Southern Atlantic Passage. So very cool. And I love the sort of confidence and the, okay, we'll get the free boat. And yeah, you will get to the other side. Of course we'll win. And then obviously doing it again, but having built something which I can only imagine the sort of emotional attachment to go through the whole process, as you said, about designing and producing this vessel that was ultimately going to carry you, but ultimately going to carry a record at the same time. It's pretty incredible. But it's incredibly interesting, given that your background in sailing and obviously boat building and naval architecture, how then did you result in this deep interest, inherent passion and skill for composites and actually looking at the materials themselves with which boats are made?
That's a good question because, you know, you work for 17 years with composite. That's what I did, build yachts for 17 years. And you work with composite on a daily basis. You know, you build these boats in serial production, actually. And you see two things, health and safety. You see these people on the floor all working with gloss, mask, things, stuff. You have styrenes in the resins. You've got boric acid in the fiberglass. And the more you're going to read about it, and the more you're going to learn about it, is that this boy dream what you do. You know, you just have you build one boat and you start to think, oh, that's cool, let's make more. And it's in the end 650 or something. You just can't go on like that. Because at a certain point, when awareness becomes a concern, then you become a hypocrite just to keep on going on. You just can't turn a blind eye anymore. So, and you can say, well, let's develop something, but in the meantime, run another company. That doesn't work like that, you know, because you need to have 100% focus on what you want to achieve. So I stopped the boat building thing. I sold that whole operation, moved to the Isle of Man, actually. That's nice. And bounced to my partner who lives on the Isle of Man. But it's a small place. It's 85,000 people. You know, it's just the dots are connected really quick. And I was already working on a sustainable alternative for fiberglass. It's difficult. It's not automatically, but if you want to have something which is sustainable, so free of all toxics and nonsense, free of styrene, free of BPA, there's bisphenol A. You can pick that up later because that's a scary thing, which is in all composite materials, boric acid in fiberglass, name it. It's just like a lot of toxic stuff, which just dump in landfill at the end of life. You know, just bury it away. You just can't do with it, nothing with it. So to make something sustainable and to make something actually circular, so that means that if you recycle it, you can reuse it forever because carbon fiber nowadays can be recycled, but every time you recycle it, it loses about 20-25% of the mechanical properties. So it becomes weaker. So for example, this desk where I'm sitting on, if you make this out of carbon fiber, you make something inferior after at the end of life. So we came up with Downy Composite, I came up with Downy Composite, which is natural-based, exceptionally strong, and you can recycle it forever. We did 3 years of R&D before we actually went to the market. So we did all the laboratory testing with Lloyd's DNV accredited laboratories. And when the first results came out, we were like absolutely baffled. Because first of all, it's not expensive. You know, you can make boats out of it just the same price as glass fiber. So we have a daughter company making power boats. We are in Glasgow right now, so it's Clyde Banks, not far away from Glasgow. They make these boats all in this material, up till the hull, deck, structure, wheelhouse, seats, dashboard. It's all made out of that. And it's so strong, and you save quite a lot of weight. So where we initially started to develop this material for boat building and solve the global problem of boats at the end of life, which we did, we thought, okay, this is so strong, we can do much more with it. So we do... Well, I showed you off record something which is on my desk, which I can't show that, unfortunately, but this is one of the super cool projects I did. And we did projects on ballistics, so it stops bullets. We do the project for high-speed trains right now. We do projects for most probably a racing boat I'm going to develop with it. Because for a racing yacht, you save weight tremendously. It's not as strong as carbon fiber, don't get me wrong. You know, if you sailed the Volvo 70, I think you sailed Telefonica, was it? In the Rorik 600, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, still remember it. That's something you cannot make out of my material. You can, but you won't break a record with it. It's too heavy because that's a Nomex carbon fiber, Nomex core pre-preg. The weight and stiffness ratio is, you just can't reach it. But when it comes to, let's say, up to 40 feet, we have something extraordinary. So all these niche kind of things, Formula One spoilers will be difficult, but everything which is, let's say, fiberglass or close to carbon fiber properties, we have an answer for a very reasonable price. For example, a boat I've built and said, well, imagine this hull is 280 kilos. Imagine it will be lighter, stiffer, and doesn't affect your IRC rating, because the moment you are having a carbon fiber hull or deck or mast or everything under IRC, your rating goes through the roof. This is just the same price as glass fiber. You save about 20-25% of the weight of a boat, and you don't get penalized on your IRC. Okay, on the weight, you have a penalty because you have a speed advantage, but not as heavy as carbon. And you have an affordable boat, so it's not so bad.
And I see to your point around, okay, it might not work on the caliber of boats such as the VO70s, but the majority of the market sits well below that. Most of our boats globally are nowhere near that spec, nor need they be, thankfully, given the general skill set in comparison to the sailors, for sure, we'd be having a lot of crazy accidents. But importantly, why is it that traditional composites, or let's say GRP, FRP construction, is so outdated now from what it actually is made of and the life issue?
When fiberglass came up, it was just like the paper bag. You know, at a certain point, the paper bag was bad for the environment because you have to cut trees and then became a plastic bag, and then everybody needs to have a plastic bag. And now everybody starts to realize that a plastic bag was not a good idea. And it's the same with fiberglass. You know, there's so much stuff we don't know. I always call it the asbestos of our time. You know, it was cheap, it was light, it's resistant, it's name it. It has all the benefits. But gosh, you speak with people who work in shipyards, they don't have a smell for the styrenes and everything. Their whole nose is gone. It creates a lot of health problems. It's no end-of-life solution. So everything, when you keep on building, if you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, fine. But if you make hundreds and thousands just boats or wind turbines and name it out of this material, at the end of life, you have absolutely no idea what to do with it. Well, if you stuff one boat in landfill, will it have an ecological bad effect? Nah, not really. But wind energy, for example, do you know how much wind turbines will end in landfill between today and 2050 globally? Guess.
I'm guessing a lot, given we're erecting more and more and more of them year on year.
Guess.
200,000.
In 43 million tons. So that's 43 billion kilograms.
Wow.
That's just unacceptable. That's unethical. I'm trying here as well, in the Isle of Man, we tried to do here a wind farm on shore here on the island, which I'm not automatically against, but bear in mind that at the end of life, what you do with these blades? Are we burying it here in our hills? It's a UNESCO biosphere. Do we put all these toxic in the ground? Not a good idea. We have a solution for that. It's not that I want to sell my innovation. I really don't care, but I care about the island. I care about the environment. And what are you going to do? To send it and bury it in a desert in Tunisia? It's unethical. We need to stop that instantly. There's not only me. Luckily, we have the only solution in the market space, which is actually circular. So you keep your materials in the economy and out of landfill. So from the boat you're talking about, you can make a wind turbine blade out of it. And from the wind turbine blade, you make my desk out of it. And from my desk, you make another boat out of it. So you use that. And that's a big benefit. And I think just on a total aspect, circular economy is something unavoidable. We plunder more than the earth can regenerate at this moment. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, we just like Thelma and Louise in all movies before your time, or you're driving your six gears straight down the cliff. That's what we're actually doing. And as long as everything goes well, and you don't see it and you don't feel it in your wallet and everything is all right, then it's very hard to break through. That's one of the problems we face, not in the yachting industry, let's say this, because the yachting industry is very conservative. We are the only one at the Ultimate Boats who are just building all these boats in this material, and we get business out of that just by doing something different, better.
When you say the boating industry is conservative, what do you mean?
Conservative for change. You know, as long as things work, and as long as you're happy with it, and as long as nobody complains about it, there's no legislations or taxes or things, and it just works, and your business goes well, then why should you change? The only reason to do this is for ecological reasons, out of a concern. But as long as you're not concerned, you know, you got awareness and concern, what I talk about. For example, climate change, people are aware of it, but think, well, I'm aware of it, but I don't care because it's nice and 40 degrees in Switzerland, in Greece, and I'm having my drink. And when people get concerned, they say, well, I'm concerned, but there's a lot of big brains that will take care of it. You know, you need to get a sort of a movement which moves people to go. So you can go to demand, to say that people want only a boat which can be recycled. And there's a lot of education there as well. I think the education is there, a big key, and taxes and legislations. For example, if I fill up my car with fuel, I pay a lot of tax on that. If somebody buys a bottle of whiskey, you pay a lot of tax on that because it's unhealthy. These kind of things needs to be taxed at a certain point. You know, you just can't avoid it anymore. When you get tax weavers on an electric car, which is not automatically smart, but it's another subject, then it's just nothing moves. That's the point. Comfort is the biggest enemy of progress. That's how it is. So as long as you're comfortable, why should you innovate? Why should you progress? Why should you make a change? Why should you do it? It's a difficult thing. As long as somebody's really concerned or really says, this is a solution, we really want to adapt because it fits our future and it fits our ESG pledges and so on, perfect.
And it has to operate as a business. And we were talking about businesses here. So why disrupt your whole model of being unless there's a really good reason why you have to? And unfortunately, I say unfortunately, and it does often make business sense why the case, but shifting on moral and ethical grounds often isn't enough to move a whole industry or industries towards something different. I mean, to your point around concern, because it's an interesting one, right? There's a difference between being aware, being concerned, and then also taking action on it. And yeah, an important element is obviously we're knowing now more than we ever have done on most topics, from climate change to medicine to whatever else. But importantly, on things like GRP and FRP voting, let's say, or even wind turbines. So relatively recently in, say, 2022, so just 2 years ago, with the University of Brighton in particular, we're starting to understand the contamination in the water of marine species associated with, you know, these E-type fragments. So these FRPs and GRPs, these little glass fragments, which are embedding themselves into obviously a variety of marine creatures. And you've called it asbestos. Like, it's exactly the sort of narrative and factual narrative that's actually now being discussed more openly around the impact that our traditional materials here are having on not just marine life, but also on ourselves. So I appreciate that the environment or fast generating ecosystems like cetaceans or shellfish can be quite good indicators, and they obviously regenerate very quickly. So we can be looking at them as good kind of proxies to what our materials and pollutants are doing. But we know now that they're, you know, things like these glass fibers are having tumors and cancers and inflammation effects on them. That's without us having done extensive research on the human body and the impact that these fibers are having on us, whether it's people who are working with them daily. And this is not to be scaremongering, rather factual. Unfortunately, it took some really graphical studies around plastics and the fact that we found them in breast milk, we found them in fetuses, we found them in testes, you know, before we actually started looking at plastics and microplastics with a similar lens. So it feels like it's only a matter of time. But the question is obviously, what then do we shift to? Because it's all well and good saying we can't use that anymore, we're going to have to legislate or tax it, but we also need solutions. So how have you approached this design question around composites differently to what we've currently got?
Well, I like your introduction a lot, because, you know, it is found in the food chain, and all these kind of things are a concern for my behalf. But when I started to develop this solution, the point is it needs to be superior to fiberglass. You know, there's something which is so strong, you just say, wow, you know, because sustainability still has a sort of cute, sweet, weak kind of era around it, you know. So when it's sustainable, it cannot be that strong, is it? You need to have something which is considerably stronger, which is almost a non-brainer, you know. So when you use it, you use less material, you save weight, you make a stronger proposition. You can recycle it forever, and you don't have all the toxics in it. To innovate something like that, the end is extremely simple, but to tick all these boxes was the most difficult thing ever, because you can create something which is sustainable, but you can't recycle it. So you've got sort of natural fibers, which you see that there's a lot of things coming up right now. You see it around on social media and everything, and it's actually really beautiful. The finishing is extraordinarily well, but you can't recycle it, because these fibers, they absorb quite a lot. You can separate materials, you dump them in landfill, which is a good step forward, but you're not there yet. So in order to make something which is sustainable and recyclable and affordable, economically viable, that's something which is kind of a difficult thing. We have a global patent on this technology, which is actually really cool, but it is difficult to tick all these boxes. And as well, my team, we've never been satisfied. Never. Like, this can be better. We need to be better. We have to think different. This is not good enough. This is good is the biggest enemy of perfect. It's good, but it's not perfect. Let's go on. Let's go on. Let's go on. More testing, more testing. And the end result is something which is perfect. It's not to preach out of my own church, because, you know, your own child is always the most beautiful and the smartest and so on and so on. But this is actually, it just works perfect. It's just how it is. I'm extremely proud of it. If you say champion sailor and all the things on transatlantics and offshore and all the stuff, you know, I think, no doubt, this is the coolest thing I've ever done in my life.
He says that waving a black stick at me. What was it you were showing there, Trent?
This was something, this is a ballistic panel. It's 12 mil thick, and we did ballistic tests with it for MOD. So you can shoot actually bullet stops, so you can mold in any shape, so you can do it in automotive parts, or you can, the impact resistance is outstanding. So we do quite a lot of stuff on impact resistance as well. And that's something, you know, you go along the line, and that's, I think that's the coolest thing of a startup, which we are. Well, we're maybe going a little bit over the stage right now being a startup, but like I said, we did it for boats. I thought, okay, that's cool. And I thought, that's strong. We can do something with wind. Oh, that feels strong. Maybe it stops a bullet. Well, why don't we test it? Okay. And you start to test it, you start to develop and stops bullets. And it's all tested independently by laboratories in the United States and laboratories in the United Kingdom, up to big brains in Germany who tested it, and all according, we got all the codings and proof and everything done. And then you enter other industries, you enter other areas. So for example, the thing that I got on my desk, as you cannot share it, but that's a helmet, something we did ourselves, thought, okay, well, it stops bullets. And you have here the Isle of Man TT. So, well, why? TT helmets are, or helmets are made of composite. So why don't we make a helmet out of it? So we did, and it passed all the tests. So you constantly go to sort of steps to a life raft container, still name it. We did all these tests we passed and all the things we do. But the biggest breakthrough is always into something which is, how do you say, it's like a tier one player. These things, they take a long time. You know, we work with only big industries. And these R&D processes are always slower than you do it on a small scale business. But then you have a breakthrough which just blows off the scale, which is great.
It's very, very, very cool. And I think that's what excites me the most about talking to people such as yourself, is the process of, let's say, the invention and the iteration. I mean, think of Sir James Dyson now, that, you know, revolutionized the vacuum cleaner, and it took 7,000 prototypes to get to the vacuum cleaner that was actually viable and usable in a domestic environment. You know, this isn't done overnight. And I think that's why it's such exceptional technology, not least because you're doing it with that high performance mindset of, this isn't yet good enough, this is nowhere near good enough, even if it's getting better, just striving for that ultimate aim. Because I mean, ultimately, as you mentioned, this isn't an opportunity to revolutionize just the marine industry. I mean, we're talking 30-40 million registered boats on the planet, let alone everyone that isn't registered, plus aviation, plus high-speed rail, plus clean energy. I mean, there are huge, huge markets which are relying on materials such as this to be more reliable, to be more circular, and also, as you rightly mentioned, to be economically viable in the process.
Yeah, that's the difficult thing, because when you talk to big industries, they say there's a lot of assumptions around. You need to take these assumptions away. So for example, when you say, well, it's not so strong. Well, I can tell you, it is really strong, because you've got here something which is just a strip of 2 mil thick, which is nothing. It's like a lollipop stick. The weight you can hang on that lollipop stick is 11 tons. So that's 4 Range Rovers. You can hang 4 Range Rovers on. And then people say, wow. And then say, well, that must be very expensive. No, it's not. It's not actually not expensive. It's actually really affordable, because we have a patent on technology. We're not supplier of resins and fibers. We don't. We don't, really don't care. We are a technology company, and these materials are off the shelf. We own a patent on the recipe. That's what we have. Mm-hmm. So for big industries, there's no supply chain industries. For example, we talk to big companies to say, well, you're just a small little company on the Isle of Man. We're not. We're not a small company. Well, we're on the Isle of Man, but we're not that. But we're not Vestas Energy, you know, or these wind turbine, I think. But they buy the materials themselves. They pay a license on the technology. Or that's where we go now for the next step. We are now, but that's a little bit, cannot say so much about it, but we're now in the process of going to produce ourselves these materials. So we're going now to go on a wider scale and produce this as an OEM producer for other companies. So we're going upscale production on not only boats, but as well on other things.
You mentioned a very important phrase there, which I liked, which was, you've got to remove the assumptions. It made me think how much we approach life with assumptions, consciously or subconsciously, which obviously hinder our progression or perhaps development or thinking outside of the proverbial box a bit better. honestly, my assumption is that having a truly forever recyclable material sounds pretty impossible, because let's take the second law of thermodynamics, number one, something has always got to be lost in the process, right? But also, there must be an incredibly energy or chemical intensive process through which the material has to go in order to be recreated into something new. What are you losing in that process? Something, presumably, but you're also having to put it under quite an intensive energy process in itself, no?
Not automatically. That's not so bad. I like your question, because it really depends on the purpose of, or for example, if you recycle one, let's say motorcycle helmet, that makes no sense. You know, that says absolutely makes no sense. It's too expensive, makes no sense. It's all stupid. And a circular economy only works when the virgin materials are more expensive than the recycled materials and just as strong. That's when it works. For example, lithium plundered all around can be recycled, but the recycle process is so expensive that you just throw it away and buy a new Tesla battery anyway. So that's one of the problems we face. For, let's say, surfboards, helmets, smaller parts, name it. We do even something for shower trays right now, or medical flooring systems here on the Isle of Man with this material. So that already indicates it's not super expensive, but it needs quite a lot of compression because it's for special medical things. But they said it was ruined. So these things are very easy to recycle. And as long as you bulk it up, then you recycle it, and then it becomes economically viable. The moment you are taking a yacht, then it becomes difficult because you have to cut it up. You try to get your fibers back, and because that's the trick. You get your fibers, if you do biaxial or unidirectional or quadraxial in a mold, you can recycle it such a way that you just can get everything back as you put it in. That's not too good to be true. That's actually true. We did it with an independent laboratory. So, for example, this, let's say, take this as a lollipop stick. We made one panel as a batch to test it until it breaks, so to bend it and to stretch it. It was all done by a laboratory in the UK. They broke it. They got all the data, so much stretch, so much flexure. From the same batch what we made, they recycled that panel because you cannot, the thing was all broken up and twisted and broken and it was all beaten up, so it's fine. From the same batch, they recycled that panel. They made a new panel out of it and they tested it again, and the results are identically strong. Wow. Identical. We invested quite a lot of money on these kind of results and to prove independent testing. It's all DNV accredited, Lloyd's accredited, stamped off laboratory reports where we actually show circularity.
But you were saying it has to be done with relatively unadulterated material.
Maybe we are a little bit ahead of the future. You know, our slogan of Exo Technology is innovating the future. I had a call with a naval architect, and he came with the question, how can you recycle this boat? I said, well, that's a very good question, because at this moment, it will be difficult. You can recycle it, but it will be very expensive for a big vessel. For smaller parts, like I said, surfboards is easy, helmets is easy, name it, other, which is all. You need to start at something with an innovation which is there. For example, the PET bottle was a recyclable bottle when they launched it. Nobody could recycle it. Now everybody can recycle it. And these recycle companies who are now jumping into, let's say, the big wind energy sector, for example, they try to get now these wind turbine blades recycled. These companies are now growing like you can't believe. And when you can recycle a 120-meter wind turbine blade, well, you can recycle a boat. That's not so difficult anymore. But these companies are now getting there. They're going to develop it. So in order to create, to feed the demand, if you stop that, if you say, for example, okay, recycle the boat, and only you say, well, yeah, we can, but it will be expensive. And you say, well, you know, I'll stay with fiberglass. Okay, I'll just stay with fiberglass. Okay. So then there's no growth in other sectors in order to get this thing moving. The wind energy sector is leading, yet they do it still in fiberglass. They still have fiberglass, and that loses mechanical properties, so you can recycle this wind turbine blade, but you dump it in the tarmac road or something. As well, the content of BPA is in this material. This, nobody actually knows how much BPA, but do you know what BPA is? It's bisphenol A, and it's in every epoxy or vinyl ester resin. It creates a sort of stability in your resins. Just 1 kilogram of that stuff. Do you know how much water that can contaminate? Guess.
I'm guessing thousands of Olympic swimming pools kind of water.
It's the size of one big drinking reservoir here on the Isle of Man. 10 billion liter. That's huge. 10 billion liter, put 2 pints of beer in it, and you cannot drink it anymore.
Awful.
That's scary stuff. That's all it is material. That means that if you bury it in landfill, it remains very stable. You know, it won't leak out. Unless you got a variety of temperatures, which you have here on the Isle of Man, for example, a lot. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's really cold. when the temperature gets unstable, this might leak out, and then it comes in drinking water, and it comes exactly as you say with the turns in the food chain.
Okay, you've developed the recipe, a combination of ingredients which result in this product, which is very lightweight, very strong, etc., etc. And at the moment, we haven't large-scale formal recycling solutions or facilities to deal with that. Therefore, it's on the wider industry, governments, councils, everything as a whole, and other clever brains to come up with a way in which that is a scalable recycling facility for such materials. How much responsibility do you place, or should we place, on the producer of the materials to come up with a recycling solution?
Well, that's a good question, because if I was the CEO, I would change everything, because I'm not automatically an eco-warrior. I wouldn't call myself that. But I did so much reading and so much study that if you don't do that, if you're not, let's say, of a sincere concern, the biggest problem where we face right now is that you have the greenwashing movements. You see, there was a certain point, a Swedish brand, I don't follow them constantly because I asked them some questions and was blocked on their social media, which was just a very kind question. I know I'm Dutch, we are very direct, but it was actually trying to be in a polite kind of way. They're selling a sustainable story. And actually my sister came up, hey, there's a sustainable boat. I said, okay, that's cool. Wow, let's see it. So it's not a sustainable boat at all. It's a fiberglass boat. The battery is not sustainable. The whole boat is not sustainable, and sell a sustainable story. I'm living and breathing this topic every single day, but when you're a consumer, you will jump into something which is just a polluted piece of junk. And there's where education comes, and that's where, for example, the demand to the market needs to come. I've been at a certain point flagging up with British Marine, for example, which didn't get me any further, which is kind of frustrating. Get a label on it. Do a survey on it. You got your ISO, you got your CE certifications, you got your DNV Lloyd's Register certifications. Why not a green label? Why not a green certification? Bang, this is a real green boat. As long as you don't do these kind of things, then who cares? But when you take a step back and really make a change towards sustainability and put an example, you can't tell your children to eat fruit and take a bite of a hamburger yourself from McDonald's. You can't. You need to set an example, especially sports people, or sports events that are the movements which can create that change. Because, Ollie, you know it as well. When you watch the ocean race like you do, or the IMOCA series, and the things are going 35 knots, or they go 30 knots. Can you see the difference on the camera? I just see a lot of water flying over the boat. I cannot really judge how fast it goes, but it's bloody impressive. And that same impressive thing you still can reach with our innovation, and that there's room in improvement to make it lighter, stiffer, and play maybe with bulkheads and stringers and things to make it a little bit smarter. Then you create or set, you set a benchmark, you set an example for where you want to be. You cannot sell a sustainable story and put a full carbon racing yacht in the water, whether you like it or not, because I love these boats, but I don't like them. I think somebody needs to set the benchmark. Somebody needs to have the guts to say, I'm done with it. We're stopping this. There's an innovation available. It's on my desk. They can test it. I don't ask a cent for the research and development. Just ask me what we do. Test it yourself. Try to break it. Try to whatever you do with it. Ask me for the lab reports. I'm sending it. And let's make a change, a positive change.
I think the carbon point is an exceptional one and probably warrants its own separate topic, podcast, conversation, features, articles, a lot, because unfortunately, despite its excellence in terms of lightweightness and strength, it's probably one of the worst materials we could be using at scale to develop boats for a myriad of reasons, environmental in particular. But I appreciate it is the material du jour, let's say, and exceptional. However, definitely short-sighted if we are rolling that out more broadly. But on your point, Jerome, around the material itself, do you feel as though the industry is moving fast enough, or industries are moving fast enough, or do you think it is also the point at which legislation and taxation now needs to come in to support a truly equal, say, shift away from materials which are demonstrably damaging to the environment, ultimately to us?
France is leading that pathway already. They have already taxes on everything which is non-recyclable. For example, if you buy a boat, you are going to pay tax on it, because you know they set up these recycle centers already throughout France, where they just can't recycle automatically the composite materials, but take the winches off and the wood out and things and stuff. And these recycle plants are already going very quick through France, and it's paid by the taxpayers who are buying these boats. So that's already something, a movement which I support. You shouldn't use that tax money to whatever, to make new roads or whatever, to do some other stuff. Use that to create recycle facilities, create jobs, create a new economy. to get this movement going. It's actually a very simple thing. You know, it's almost free money. You can say, well, put 10% in it. You can do it tomorrow and it'll be accepted anyway. What are you going to do? Nothing. You can't do nothing about it. And I think as well, for a certain reason, when companies are not doing it, not changing, the moment you feel it in your wallet, so your turnover goes down or your profit is going down, that's the moment they will change. Everything becomes liquid under pressure, and that's exactly what needs to be done. Because as long as you have not a person who says, we have ESG pledges, we want to make a tube to lead the pathway to a greener future, and doesn't see that, then it makes no sense talking. Europe is leading this thing. In Northern Europe, especially, like the Netherlands, where I'm from, is really pushing these things forward. I'm pretty proud to be Dutch. Scandinavian countries are doing it really well. So yeah, you see this movement going, and I think that should be an example for the rest of the world.
It should be. And I think, honestly, sitting here, both of us are sitting in the United Kingdom having this conversation. It's somewhat disappointing, I find, that like many other countries, there are a lot of brilliant minds. There's a lot of maritime history and a legacy here in the UK. And it's a real pity, I think, as an industry, we haven't shifted fast enough. But as you said, there's probably not yet enough pressure. And you mentioned something earlier, sometimes, you know, movements can come from the bottom up. But ultimately, if the general populace doesn't appreciate the impact that these substances are having, then that movement can't come as easily from the bottom up. It has to at some point be a top-down reaction, which is ultimately what we're seeing, as you've rightly said, in places like Europe and France in particular, on boat taxation. So if you're buying a new boat in France, you pay the end-of-life tax ultimately as the purchaser, so that it can be dealt with when it comes to the end of life. It's a very interesting model, a very clever model, and certainly one which is, you know, a start. Like anything, we'll find new novel ways, solutions, which make the whole system work a little bit better. Because it's a sort of duplicitous issue. We've got the virgin composite recycling issue opportunity. So any kind of byproduct or leftovers from creating new boats, new wind turbines, that's all virgin material, which isn't easily recyclable. GRP, GRP bits. And obviously the end of life boats, which are heavily adulterated, as you'll appreciate, 30 years owning a vessel these days, and it's been touched up and epoxied and varnished and whatever else. So it's not easy to break apart, nor is it economically viable in most cases. So it's definitely the very beginning, I should say. Feels a little bit somewhat delayed and postponed increasingly. But I think minds such as yourself and your team and others working in the industry are genuinely finding opportunities to shift this quite dramatically, not least for the revolution of new materials to be built with. You mentioned something that's quite interesting, was being able to recycle the sort of bike helmets and surfboards are manageable, but actually the size of a vessel, perhaps not. I think we forget, however, that take away the hull, as in take away the ballast, effectively, the keel of a boat, and all the, obviously the mast and everything else, you're talking about a very hollow space. You can crush it down somewhat. It's actually a lot less than the actual ultimate size of the boat. So your 37-foot boat is something akin to 2 square meters worth of material, even though it looks a lot larger. So that too surely is taken into account when you think about recycling it.
It will be possible at scale. You know, even a bigger boat will be recyclable at scale. No, that's not a problem. You see this French movement, they say, I think it's called APER. That's the French company, which is governmental supported. They stripped the boat until actually you put to a hull and a deck. That's it. And at a certain point, they didn't have so much to do with it. So now you see already composite recycling companies say, hey, I can do it. Just chop it up and give it to me. Chop it up is one thing. Transport is another thing. Recycle is then another thing. And in the end, you have materials which you have to dump away anyway. And that's the difficult part of it. This, you don't throw away. So for example, the helmet I just showed you, which I cannot show in front of the camera. But for example, the visor in this helmet will be cut out by water because this thing comes out of one mold. So you got hundreds and thousands of these visors which are cut out and thrown away. These can be recycled and these materials can be back in the helmet again. Like the color of the helmet, for example, they're all, you put it in a mold, there will be water cut off. These things you can recycle everything. You just bulk it up till you got a certain amount, you recycle it, you got your fibers back and you got the resins back, you make a helmet out of it. That's a pretty cool story. And that's, like I said, it's actually true. It's possible. It's off my desk. It's right here.
I have seen it. I can attest to anyone listening. I think it also goes back to the design question, right? We're basing on assumptions. Have we become so used to assuming there will be waste product when we produce anything? rather than approaching the design question with no waste in mind. I mean, I think there are whole sort of subconscious biases which we have ingrained in the way that we have arguably thousands and thousands of years produced things. So going back to your point of assumptions, and I have actually written it down, sort of assumptions, because it's worth us challenging ourselves what we're predisposed to believe. If we're designing, our design specifications are waste less, then we'll be looking at it very differently.
Since the Industrial Revolution, what we did, we take things from the planet, we make something out of it, we use it, and we throw it away.
But in the process of making, there is also waste. I was just envisaging, say, visors, or I don't know, this hand sanitizer, this little plastic cap will be laid out as a sheet, which we cut. There'll be margins that are wasted. There'll be extra bits and pieces that don't go into making this. So in the production process, there is wasted virgin material too.
Exactly. Yeah, you see it in boats. You know, for example, composite boats is about 20. You got all the lines in the vacuum infuser. They can throw it away. A lot of resin thrown away. A lot of trim lines is all thrown away. So just there's a lot of waste. But the moment you can say there's waste, you can recycle it. Like, for example, like I said, the helmet, this waste part, you can recycle and use it back in the end material again. That's something possible. That's actually something I never thought about until I was having a meeting with one of these guys with who we did the helmet. And that's something I thought, okay, that's actually not so stupid, because I just thought, let's recycle a helmet. So that goes much further. And then you can see a sort of movement. This helmet is not ready yet. Well, it is ready because it's tested, but needs to go through homologation and all sorts of things. It takes forever, which is fine. Making step by step. But at least that's something which you create a movement of something who just gets it, just wants to lead, wants to be the world's first doing something different. That's really cool to do.
Now, Jerome, what's your ask of the industry, let's say marine industry more broadly, when it comes to thinking about end of life and also composites?
Trigger me. Prove me I'm wrong. Let's make your life easy. I can. If you don't care about the planet, then do it for the next generation. If you want to have something which is just superior, to be different, to be the world's first, to do something out of extraordinary, to lead the pathway, to have the answers today for questions you will definitely get tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, got them here, trigger me. Really, just contact me, send me a message on LinkedIn, whatever, and let's make it happen.
I'm not laughing only because I know you and I know that you're serious. And I also think it would make such a fantastic T-shirt slogan if we all had to trigger me. Because it's important, right? I think it's important also for you to be challenged and for your team to be challenged. For anyone who's looking at new solutions, it's really important to be grilled on the viability of your solution, right? It's how we all progress.
Yeah, for example, we did the helmet. This is our own initiative, by the way. We just thought, okay, let's make a helmet. You know, let's do it. Let's do something like this. This is a weird kind of thing to do because we thought, okay, it stops bullets. And that was something like, and as well, especially my team said to me, you can't do that. My sister always said it to me when I was young, when I was a little boy, you can't do it. And I always did it, you know, and did it twice and made a selfie. Well, you didn't have selfies at that time. The point is, trigger me is exactly this. This thing took me nights almost to get it right. It's not a simple thing to do, to make it within the margins of weight and thickness and things and stuff to make it happen. And when it works, we tested it. I thought, bloody hell, this is actually really strong. It just works. So first we did a little panel, we tested it, well, passed. We made 8 panels, 7 passed, 1 didn't. It was ridiculously thin. Then we said, oh, let's make a helmet out of it, so it works. And now we're opening dialogue with helmet manufacturers to see, like, they got something on my desk, maybe something interesting for you. So now it starts to be picked up and this whole discussion is going. But this is something we did on our own initiative. But I broke my head, because it's a helmet, but it was a lot of thinking to make something as complex as it is within the margins, make it 14% lighter as a race helmet, and it works. So that's why I said, trigger me, throw it on my desk, and let's make it happen. Just somebody who says, well, interesting, let's contact me, send me a message on LinkedIn or whatever, WhatsApp or an email, and throw it on my desk, and let's see what we can do.
Jerome Watts, former champion sailor and now composite revolutionist, thank you so much for your time today. Really enjoyed the conversation. And the two biggest things I've taken away personally are the concept to sort of trigger me, you know, in terms of personal growth and invention and innovation. Very cool way of looking at the world. And also the understanding of assumptions. How are we approaching things very similarly, even if we believe that we are not? So thank you again very much for your time. I'm very excited to see what Exo Technologies and Danu Composites come up with in the coming days and years.
Thank you so much for your time, Ollie. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Clean Sailors podcast. All relevant links to the projects and people we talk to can be found with the podcast link. For all episodes or to get in touch, just visit cleansailors.com. We love to hear from you. We believe that great ideas should be shared, which is why our podcast is free to appear on. So if you've got a project, idea, or topic you think we should be discussing, get in touch. In the meantime, thank you for listening and see you for the next episode.